Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group is hosting a panel discussion on the U.S. Supreme Court nomination and confirmation process. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers, not of the Federalist Society or any of the speakers' firms or universities. My name is Rachel Brand. I'm with the law firm WilmerHale in Washington, D.C., and I am moderating this podcast today on behalf of the Federalist Society. We have a very qualified panel to discuss the topic of Supreme Court confirmations today, representing Democratic and Republican former White House officials and expert commentators with diverse philosophical views. Our first panelist is Tom Goldstein, one of the preeminent Supreme Court litigators in the country today and a partner at Akin Gump here in Washington, D.C. He is also the founder and publisher of SCOTUS Blog, a go-to source of commentary and insight about the Supreme Court on the web. Our next panelist will be Dave Strauss, currently a law professor at the University of Minnesota Law School. Professor Strauss's scholarship focuses on the judiciary as an institution, and he is a leading academic expert on the judicial confirmation process. He has also observed the Supreme Court from the inside, having clerked for Justice Thomas. Our third panelist is Sarah Wilson, currently a partner at Covington & Burling in Washington. She brings an insider perspective to this panel, having served in President Clinton's White House counsel's office as the lawyer primarily responsible for handling judicial appointments, including preparations for a potential Supreme Court nomination. She also brings the unique perspective of having gone through a judicial confirmation fight herself. She was nominated by President Clinton to the U.S. Court of Federal Claims and was ultimately recess appointed to that court. Our final panelist will be Professor Bill Kelly of Notre Dame Law School. Professor Kelly also provides valuable insider knowledge, as he was Deputy White House Counsel during the nomination and confirmation of Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, and was integrally involved in shepherding the nominees through that process. Professor Kelly is also former law clerk to Justice Scalia. I will ask each of the panelists to make 5 to 7 minutes of opening remarks, after which each of them will have the opportunity to present a couple minutes of rebuttal. I will then pose questions to the panelists. Tom, do you want to start?
Thanks so much, Rachel, and I really appreciate the Federalist Society putting together this program. In my experience, no organization comes close to the Federalist Society in bringing together groups of people from diverse perspectives on current and timeless questions in the law. I thought that given the breadth of our topic, which is about confirmations, but it happens in the context, of course, of the Stevens retirement and the nomination and the ensuing confirmation process for his successor, that I might look at that the issue of confirmations through that lens. Not going to talk about jurisprudence of the court, which I think will shift to the right in the wake of Justice Stevens' departure, but rather what it is that this White House and groups on the progressive side, which is what I'm more familiar with, are thinking about in this process. You might imagine that this White House, having been elected on a relatively progressive mandate with 59 members of the Senate, if you include the independents, might well take an aggressive posture towards a Supreme Court nomination and confirmation in looking to someone who's relatively liberal, very solid on the left on these sorts of questions. And I just don't think there's any evidence that that's how this White House has looked at the question. They're the most significant liberal candidates who are plausible, haven't really been a part of the process. You would think of someone like Pam Carlin, a brilliant liberal legal professor. Martha Minow was named in the process, but not that seriously considered. Sidney Thomas is a judge somewhere on the left and has been thought about seriously, but I don't think is one of the very most serious candidates. And Diane Wood is looked at as being reasonably on the left, including because of her abortion positions, but isn't a kind of liberal leader. On top of that, I think the two most serious candidates, when you think about the who were considered for this position, Elena Kagan and Merrick Garland through the process, aren't people who have liberal track records. And that strikes me as distinctly different from how conservatives and the Bush administration looked at the nomination process. Now, it's always easy for someone on the left to say, oh, the folks who are nominated by the other side are so much more conservative. And I think that reflects a bias on each ideological side. We don't really tend to understand the natural centrism of a lot of the people who are thought about for these positions. But liberal groups have relatively little to say in this process, and there's no prospect at all of a kind of Harriet Myers reaction to the nomination of someone whose views aren't very well known. I think conservatives understand so much better the value and importance of the court, the timeless nature of the decisions that it makes, the impact they have on American life. And conservatives have been able to motivate themselves and constituencies because they are, in effect, fighting against something, a significant view that the Supreme Court overreached on the left, and that there needs to be a course correction, whereas it's only now that an impression is emerging on the left in the wake of decisions like Citizens United that the president has tried to draw attention to, that on some level you can run against the Supreme Court, perhaps. In terms of how the confirmation process itself will go, because I don't think that this is going to turn into a big ideological fight, I think that there won't be a real war in the Senate, a discussion of a filibuster and the like. And I'm prepared to be disappointed even by the extremely low standards of the ordinary confirmation process, where we don't have really good probing questions and we don't get illuminating answers. It's interestingly, Elena Kagan, who wrote the strongest article on this question about how essential it is that there be really in-depth questions and answers so that we can educate the public and determine whether the nominee is the right person for the job. I just don't expect to see that through the confirmation hearing. So I think that this is going to be a process driven to the center, which is not a bad thing. It's just a little bit surprising from a Democratic president with a strong Democratic majority in the Senate.
Tom, thank you very much. That was very informative. We'd like to move on now to Professor Strauss.
Thank you, Rachel. And I, too, would like to echo what Tom said. I think that this is a wonderful idea to do this podcast, and I look forward to debating this issue. I am obviously not an insider, but I have spent time researching the confirmation process, talking to people who have been on the inside of the confirmation process, and looking at it from an academic point of view. So I'm going to start out, actually, with a point of agreement with Tom, which is that I think that the president is likely to nominate somebody who is fairly moderate, but perhaps for different reasons. I think that politically, coming off the healthcare vote, the prospect of losing a substantial number of seats in both the Senate and the House this fall, with the Republican base very activated, I'm not sure that particularly congressional Democrats are excited about the prospect of a really drawn out, bitter battle over a Supreme Court nominee. I think that Tom is correct in his statement that the Republican base seems to care a lot more politically about judges for whatever reason than the Democratic base does. So coming up with a very controversial nominee, I think, would adhere to the benefits of the Republicans, but not so much to the Democrats. So I agree with Tom on that point. The one thing I might disagree on is the impact of the Citizens United case. You know, the president did mention it, the State of the Union. He has mentioned it in the past, and they are sort of using that as a banner for this particular Supreme Court appointment. I'm just not sure, based on the history of appointments, having researched 80 years of appointments, that something like Citizens United, as important as it may be to the democratic process from both sides, I'm not sure that that's going to capture the public attention or the attention of Congress quite as much as issues like abortion or affirmative action or race or things of that nature. Moving on, I also want to talk a little bit about President Obama and sort of back up a bit and talk about his history in terms of how he's approached the nomination process. I think that another sort of indicator that he's not likely to want a fight is how he has approached nominating individuals in the past. So I have a few statistics here. President Bush inherited 81 federal vacancies, 27 appellate court vacancies, and 54 district court judges or vacancies when he came into the White House. President Obama inherited 54 vacancies, 13 appellate court, and 41 district court vacancies. Currently, there are 104 vacancies, 18 appellate vacancies, and 86 district vacancies. Not counting Justice Stevens, there are expected to be 26 additional vacancies during this Congress alone. But what's been surprising is the slow movement that President Obama has made in terms of filling these vacancies. So out of those 104 vacancies, President Obama has only made 57 nominations to date, and that includes the nomination and eventual confirmation of Justice Sonia Sotomayor. 31 of Obama's nominations were made in 2009, and I'll get to Bush's numbers in a second, but that's much slower than Bush went during his first months in office. The remaining 25 have been made in 2010. 19 of President Obama's nominees have been confirmed, one Supreme Court justice, seven Court of Appeals judges, and 11 district court judges. Now, on to the comparison between the two administrations. So during the first 9 months of the Bush presidency, President Bush had made 60 nominations, or 74% of the total inherited vacancies. In the first 9 months of President Obama's term in office, he had made only 22 nominations, not counting Justice Sotomayor. So only 41% of his inherited vacancies were filled. Another interesting fact is some sort of on the Democratic side have been talking about the fact that the Republicans in Congress have been obstructionists. And you see this from both sides. The Republicans claim the Democrats are obstructionists and vice versa, depending on who controls the White House. An interesting fact is the average number of days from nomination to hearing for President Bush's nominees was 116 days for appellate court nominees, 70 for district court nominees, for an 83-day average. For President Obama, perhaps because he has been a little bit more, has waited a little bit longer than President Bush to nominate folks to the courts, has waited 43 days on average for appellate court nominees, 54 days for district court nominees, and a 49-day average. Another interesting fact as well is that the average age of President Obama's nominees has been 56 years old for the circuit court nominees, which is 6 years older than the average age of circuit court nominees over the past 30 years. So I think that those statistics demonstrate that for whatever reason, despite the fact that President Obama taught constitutional law at the University of Chicago, despite the fact that he served as a practicing lawyer, it shows that perhaps President Obama is not as serious as past presidents have been about filling vacancies. So at least as compared to President Bush. Now, briefly, I'd also like to go back to what Tom had said, which is to talk about Justice Stevens. I do think that the Justice Stevens vacancy is probably the most important vacancy that President Obama is likely to fill during his term in office, even if he serves for 8 years, unless somebody like Justice Kennedy or Justice Scalia retires during the period. Justice Stevens now, academically, we've looked at his decisions. He is now the most reliably liberal justice on the court. His Martin Quinn scores, which are sort of a dynamic score that academics have come up with to measure ideology, are now reliably the most liberal. He also has the wealth of experience. He's been on the court, more than 30 years. He's the intellectual leader of the left of the court. Now the quote liberal, the most liberal member of the court with the longest tenure will be Justice Ginsburg. So I think that there's going to be a real hole to fill on the liberal side of the court. And I think that makes this an enormously important appointment for President Obama. But I do think that there's something to what folks have been saying that President Obama, by picking somebody who's more moderate, as Tom suggests, may actually be doing more service for sort of progressive values on the court, because any justice who's appointed is going to have to persuade Justice Kennedy, and Justice Kennedy is clearly now the swing justice on the court. So I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next several months as this nomination is made and then winds its way through the Senate.
Okay, thanks, Dave. Sarah, you're up next.
Thanks, Rachel, and I want to echo the appreciation of Tom and David for the Federal Society hosting this program, and I think it's fair to say that together with its partner, the American Constitution Society, that the amount of education and the quality of the public dialogue on the important issue of judicial confirmations has been substantially enhanced. So I really appreciate your asking me to participate. I wanted to focus on three points in introduction. The first is to share with you my personal experience as a former Clinton White House counsel, associate counsel working on judicial nominations, share a personal experience with Clinton's brush with the possibility of filling Justice Stevens' vacancy, or what we thought might be a vacancy during the latter part of his second presidential term. And then secondly, reflect a little bit on the kinds of choices that and candidacies that Obama might be focused on, at least the ones that have attracted the most press attention at this stage. And then close with some reflections along the lines of the reflections that David just proffered up on the impact of the Supreme Court confirmation process on lower court judicial nominations. So first, let me take a very brief trip down memory lane. When I was working in the White House counsel's office in the late 90s, the then White House counsel, Chuck Ruff, got what he thought was a very reliable report that Justice Stevens was going to retire imminently. And for a period of about 6 to 8 weeks, a few of us in the counsel's office went into very high gear to develop a short list of top candidates for this potential impending vacancy. And the process, as you might expect, was highly accelerated. It was very, very intense, lots of all-nighters during a period of a month or so. And to me, at the end of the day, it demonstrated how much of a difference even the brief passage of time and shifting of political context makes to the nomination and confirmation process, perhaps particularly so with Supreme Court candidacies, but also with lower court nominations and confirmations. It was no secret that President Clinton wanted to nominate the first Hispanics to the high court, and although that one of our first steps was to dig out the so-called shortlist, was actually about 20 pages long, from storage, the list of candidates that he considered during his first term for the Ginsburg and Breyer vacancies. But we quickly realized that list had become kind of outdated and frankly didn't contain a lot of Hispanic candidates. And so we set off to develop a different list, and ultimately winnowed it down to three top contenders, all of whom were Hispanic federal judges, those two appellate judges on the Second Circuit, and somewhat surprisingly, one Hispanic district court candidate, or district court judge, rather. Having worked on then-Judge Sonia Sotomayor's rather bruising Second Circuit nomination, the assignment fell to me to make the case for her potential candidacy to fill Justice Stevens' seat. And the way these things work is that you basically review every single published decision, sometimes trial transcripts, publications, speeches of every candidate, whether a judge or an academic or public figure, and write, you know, what usually amounts to a very lengthy tome, picking out certain themes and trying to develop a sense of their body of work to present it in a memo. And then, of course, I also did an executive summary, given that there was a lengthy tome. And Sonia Sotomayor, in the late 90s, as a result of her bruising political fight to get onto the Second Circuit, was really viewed internally as sort of the confirmation prospect underdog. Nevertheless, after we submitted the memos, I got a call from Air Force One with some questions and comments. And although they were not determinative and President Clinton never had an opportunity to make a final choice, because the rumor turned out to be, or the report that Stevens was going to retire turned out to be inaccurate, I interpreted the interest in her potential candidacy as a sign that perhaps President Clinton might, despite the confirmation challenges, which seemed evident from the experience that the president and Judge Sotomayor had gone through for the Second Circuit vacancy, despite those challenges, he might have opted to actually fight what could have been a pretty tough confirmation battle. There are a couple of sort of major takeaways for me from this experience. One is that there is really true, as there should be, there is sort of a credentials baseline for Supreme Court candidates. There's been a lot written about the sort of professionalization of the federal judiciary. Most of the top candidates considered by President Obama are federal appellate judges. I don't think that is a trend that's going to go away, despite sort of stated Ivy League exhaustion among some segments of the public. I think that that professionalization trend is here to stay and actually serves a useful purpose. Diversity politics are important, particularly as presidential candidates come close to presidential elections. Certainly in 1999, diversity politics with the 2000 election cycle looming were very, very important. And the interest in an Hispanic nominee was not entirely driven by that factor, but certainly that was an important factor. And then finally, the sort of during periods of divided government, the amount of anxiety over a candidate's confirmability really became, at least in my experience, almost more important than ideological concerns. The two can be paired together, but I think that Tom might sort of help explain some of the sort of disappointment among liberal groups that Democratic presidents, when in power, don't gravitate towards more sort of obviously liberal candidates, because the confirmation politics, even with a Senate majority that is the same as the president's party, is just a very tough factor to have to deal with. And then finally, I guess a takeaway from this experience with Judge Sotomayor being considered during President Clinton's term for a Supreme Court vacancy was that the ghost of nominations past really have a tremendous effect on the future trajectory of nominations. So scroll forward a decade and, you know, it sort of felt like deja vu all over again when Judge Sotomayor became the top contender and then the ultimate pick for a Supreme Court vacancy. And interestingly, although she would have been, I think, a much bolder pick had President Clinton selected her for a vacancy that turned out not to be, by the time Obama selected her, although there was some controversy, she had been significantly neutralized just by virtue of her service on the Second Circuit for a decade or so. You know, one could say the same thing about Justice Roberts. You know, his failed candidacy during Bush 1, you know, the Democrats holding him up for the D.C. Circuit had a huge impact on his later nomination. It also had an impact on the D.C. Circuit failed candidacy of Elena Kagan, and played some more limited role on Merrick Garland's difficulty in getting confirmed. But the sort of history of nominations past really does carry a lot of weight when it comes to judicial confirmation battles in the future.
Great. Thanks a lot, Sarah. And finally, Bill, we'll move on to you.
Well, I also am happy to be doing this. I think it's interesting and important and educational. It certainly has been for me. I'm going to speak a little bit from the perspective of a person who has, in the not-so-distant past, been on the inside going through the process of advising a president on whom he should choose and then getting those nominees confirmed. And the last point made by Susan, I think, is very important, which is that the confirmation process, and particularly past confirmation processes, haunt everything that happens. And the most important factor, I think, always in any confirmation process and what precedes it, is how many senators the president's party has sitting at that particular time. So I think the most important fact of all right now is the number 59, which is the number of Democratic senators, obviously. And that means that President Obama has a whole lot of latitude to get confirmed, I think, virtually anyone whom he wants to spend the capital to get done. And from the standpoint of a Democratic activist or the Democratic base who might care about judicial appointments more than it seems as though the White House has prioritized them, it must be very frustrating to have that much power in the Senate and still not a commitment to getting a nominee through who would please the base. I don't know why they've made that judgment. From the standpoint of a lawyer advising inside, confirmability is, you know, an essential thing. The politics of who whoever the president picks and the pros and cons politically of the pick, I didn't really think were the job of the lawyers to worry about. But we did worry about, well, could a nominee get 51 votes? So against the background of the necessity of making sure that you have enough votes in the Senate, you know, the president needs to consider, obviously, a variety of factors. First, and I think indispensably from the standpoint of any president, should be judicial philosophy. Any nominee he picks should share his judicial philosophy. I think that's part of the spoils of winning elections, that your approach to law is one that will be reflected in the nominees you pick for the court. And that's how it's always been. I think that's how it will be. I think the confirmation fights over the last couple of decades have witnessed the Senate waking up to that, to the fact that, well, gee, they don't have to agree with the president's judicial philosophy, and it's now a perfectly acceptable basis to vote against the nominee based on those grounds alone. In addition to judicial philosophy, I think one lesson from the Bush nominations was that undisputed professional excellence is absolutely essential. Both the Chief Justice and Justice Alito had really unparalleled or unsurpassed professional reputations, both as lawyers and judges. And it makes it very hard to get ground with the public, and especially, I think, with the media, in attacking a nominee if you have to begin by acknowledging just how professionally distinguished the person is, and then the next sentence begins with "but." And that changes the terms of the debate in the confirmation process. A variety of other factors that need to be considered, obviously, are matters like what's been called diversity politics. And a factor that has currently become quite relevant is, I'll say, experiential diversity. Will the president pick a person who's not a sitting judge for the court? I think it's an interesting question. Obviously, our history has witnessed that half or more than half of the justices throughout history have not served as judges, have not been sitting judges at the time of appointment, but not since 1972 has a justice gone on the court without having been a judge beforehand. And I think part of the reason why that is so is can be traced to how much more difficult the confirmation process has become over the last two or three decades. It's much easier, I think, to get a sitting judge confirmed than it would be to get a politician confirmed. And it surely will be a daunting task, say, if the president picks pick a politician, Jennifer Granholm from Michigan. Governor Granholm is going to answer for every prosecutorial decision, every policy decision. It's all policy when you're a politician. And a sitting judge can always and should always say, I was just doing my job of following the law as I saw fit. And the separation of a sitting judge from the policy outcomes of cases in the confirmation process is a very, very valuable thing to have when you're sitting before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And for a sitting governor, for example, that would be much more difficult to be in the position of defending one's policy views as opposed to one's just legal views. And I think that another factor that has led us disproportionately to pick judges in recent years has been that they've shown that they're good at the job of being a judge. It's hard to be a judge. It's hard to do it well. The court's role has become so much more important, and at least it's been perceived as becoming more important, and the stakes have become so high with every nomination that a judicial record is something that's very comforting for a president to have to look to when choosing a nominee. In the current situation, the Solicitor General, Elena Kagan, doesn't have a judicial record, and that is worrying to some people who are looking at the possibility of her appointment, because she's never really had to speak for herself on really any legal question. Her scholarship is not provocative, and her work as a lawyer is limited. And most of what's known about her, about her views, stems from the titles she's had. She was a very important player in the Clinton White House, both in the counsel's office and on the policy side. She's the dean of a major law school and very successful, and now the Solicitor General. But she doesn't have, from the standpoint of a person advising the president, she doesn't have a real record of how she approaches deciding legal questions as a judge, and that unknown is worrying. And in this context, with the stakes being so high, the prospect of an unknown means that it's a risk, and why would you take risks when you have sitting judges whom you can be confident in how they perform the task of being a judge? Another factor that hasn't been talked about a lot, I guess, but I think it is interesting in the current situation, is the question of religious diversity. I think it's extremely unlikely that the president will appoint a Catholic, another Catholic to the court, and it will be quite something if the court has no Protestants on it. Even as we acknowledge immediately that one's religious background or religious views don't have any bearing on one's work as a judge, and of course the Constitution prohibits a religious test for office anyway. But in over the course of our history, things like religious identity, geographic diversity, and of course more recently sex and race-based diversity are matters that have to be considered by any president. And the fact that now there are six Catholics and two Jewish people on the court means that the president at least has to worry about that as he decides on his nominee. And finally, again, I want to go back to the reality of the Senate. 59 votes is a lot of votes. If the president wants someone confirmed, it would be extraordinarily unlikely that he wouldn't succeed. It would take a truly provocative nominee to get no Republican support. I suppose that's possible. I think three Democrats voted for Justice Alito, so that's not very many. But in the confirmation process, the number 59, again, is everything as matters stand now, which means that they have to get it done this summer. The closer we get to the election and then post-election, the situation changes, because who knows how many seats there will be for the Democrats in the Senate after November, and the politics of the situation change dramatically after the election. Now, it's inconceivable that they won't have the nominee picked and confirmed before the election unless some disaster strikes. For example, an unknown ethical problem surfaces, or something catastrophic could happen that could delay the confirmation or require the choice of a new nominee. And if you're advising the president today on whom he should pick, the one thing you can't afford is a mistake on a matter like ethics that will surprise you. So I guess I'm done.
Great. Thanks, Bill. Well, we have a brief amount of time for some rebuttals. If each of you could just make one or two points if you have anything to say in rebuttal to the other panelists' presentations. If you don't have anything in rebuttal, that's fine. But just keep it brief, and then we'll move on to questions. Tom, should we start with you?
Only to say that I'm just so pleased to be part of a program that, I'm learning so much, and I just love the level of thoughtfulness and civility of it. I also particularly appreciate the personal stories of folks who've been involved in the process in the White House counsel's office and otherwise. I think those are, rather than speculation by somebody like me, to hear from folks who've been in it, and also the careful study of the data, I think, is really useful. I wish that we could come up with a better model for confirmation. I wish that we could move towards a system where the public would learn and the nominees would really be in a position where they would talk, because it's so rare that the country focuses on the critical questions about the construction of the Constitution and law. And so I'm saddened by the state of the process, but I guess heartened that we might be headed in the direction of at least less partisan warfare over the Supreme Court and maybe other judgeships.
Okay, Dave, anything?
Yeah, I agree with Tom on the point he makes. The personal stories have been so rich and so interesting that I very much appreciated sort of supplementing my own knowledge and the knowledge of our listeners. I think that they're extraordinary stories. I do want to talk really quickly about one thing that both Sarah and Bill talked about, which is the professionalization of the judiciary. I am one of those people that thinks that is not necessarily a good thing. As Bill mentioned, over half of our justices have not been sitting judges at the time of their nomination to the Supreme Court. I think that that's good. I think it provides more diversity for the court. I recently wrote an article on a obscure justice, Justice Pierce Butler, And Pierce Butler and Louis Brandeis, neither of whom had judicial careers, really served the court in an extraordinary capacity because they were railroad lawyers and experts on railroad law. And at the time of their appointment, railroad law was like internet law. It was a huge part of the docket of the United States Supreme Court. I think 30% of the cases dealt in some way with railroads. And so, you know, I think that that the professionalization of the judiciary has been a negative overall. I do think it's here to stay, but I would like to see presidents in the future look more broadly at practicing lawyers, at members of the executive department, at state court judges, at district court judges. I think that there is a wealth of knowledge and experience out there that is not being tapped into. I also think the professionalization of the judiciary, and particularly the Supreme Court, is in part due to presidents trying to find a reliable conservative or reliably liberal candidate. That judicial record that nominees has is such an important predictor of how they're going to perform on the Supreme Court. And to have that record, I think, makes each and every pick that they make for the Supreme Court that much safer. And perhaps it's not true that having years of record as a prosecutor or years of record as a practicing lawyer would provide the same information to presidents. So, you know, I view that as an unfortunate sort of consequence of our current confirmation process.
Sarah?
Yeah, on the I guess the experience factor, I'm reminded of a comment that I heard Judge Garland make a couple of years ago at a D.C. Circuit Historical Society event. He was asked by a member of the audience, for tips about what it takes to become a great appellate lawyer, and his response was two words. It was trial experience. And although it was a somewhat unexpected response, you know, I think it sort of speaks to the question of and his perception in particular that I happen to agree with, that you know, that appreciating the work in a very practical way of the judges whose decisions you are in a position to review is, you know, a critical component of doing the job. I don't mean to suggest that I don't share some of the sentiments that others have expressed about sort of, and I think a real sort of legitimate kind of longing for choices, you know, more imaginative choices who come from different walks of life and not just the ranks of the federal judiciary, especially the appellate ranks, you know, in the same sort of circle of law schools and that kind of thing. I do share some of that sentiment. Ironically, Elena Kagan is actually the one who presents as the sort of non-traditional choice in that respect, although she's a very traditional and well-credentialed background in other respects. So I think there's sort of merit to both sides of the argument. But I do, my own prediction would be that Senator Obama sort of sticks with one of the kind of safer choices, someone with excellent credentials and some, sort of top-notch experience.
Okay, Bill, any rebuttal from you?
Yes, it's not rebuttal, it's comment. If we grant that there's value to coming on the court without having been a judge, it has to be something about how one's life experience and one's experience prior to coming on the court will affect in some way your work or the work of the court. And there might be political or symbolic value too as well. But Elena Kagan really isn't that. I mean, it would be hard to be more establishment than Elena Kagan. And it's not a long way from being Solicitor General to being on the D.C. Circuit in terms of one's day-to-day legal experience. I guess I don't have a strong view whether it would be good to have non-judges or not. What does strike me is that the process as it stands today makes it very, very challenging and very risky to get a non-judge confirmed. And it's not just what I mentioned earlier. There are additional factors as well. First, the public, for better or worse, I think this experience with Harriet Myers in some ways reflects this, has come to view the court as really an elite place where you have to be some sort of legal genius to be a justice. You have to really be in some way very experienced in American constitutional law and constitutional practice, and the vision, the politics, and the media treatment of the court is such that you really have to be viewed as quite elite to be taken seriously as a nominee. And, you know, there are not a lot of practicing lawyers who are going to be in the position of appearing that way, at least at the outset of the early days after a nomination. And sure, there are some practicing lawyers who are very experienced in public law and constitutional law in particular, but again, I mean, they're not the politician, the Governor Warren type that I think some people are pining for. And it's important also to remember that the confirmation process starts long before the nominee appears before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And one factor in my own experience that surprised me at the outset, and then it became a very important thing to deal with, was that the day after the president announces a nomination, the nominee is making courtesy calls to senators. And that's immediate, and it's substantive. And nominees need to be on and impressive from day one with the senators. And if in some way you're not sufficiently glib, or you're not sufficiently impressive or intimidating to the senators, then you start out with much more of an uphill climb than you otherwise would. So if the president picks the equivalent of Earl Warren for the court, on day one he's got to talk constitutional law with members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And in a context unlike in the past, where the senators from the other party begin with a presumption of hostility against you. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
Thanks, Bill. I'd like to ask a question about the confirmation hearings. And I'm taking this off of something Tom said. Tom sort of pined for a hearing that would involve more substantive answers from the nominee to the senator's questions. And my question is whether they should answer the question. Bill, I wanted to open it up to you, given your experience helping Justices Roberts and Alito get ready for their confirmation hearings, and they, during the preparation, spent a lot of time thinking about to what extent they would answer senators' questions about particular questions of law. What are your thoughts on what the right rule is?
Well, I think it's a prudential judgment where the line is between what you ought to talk about and what it would be improper to talk about. And it's really a divide between, well, you really should talk about the things you can, and you really can't talk about the things that you shouldn't. And, you know, Justice Ginsburg in her hearings was very, very emphatic on the fact that a sitting judge can't be expressing prospectively views about stuff that might come before her. And we can quarrel with how she drew the line or how Justice Scalia did, which included not signing on to Marbury against Madison, and how Justice Alito or Chief Justice Roberts did. I think the desire that we have, the people who follow these things, for a really substantive open exchange, a la the Bork hearings, is really kind of a fantasy, first of all, and secondly, and maybe it's a good fantasy, but it's just not going to happen. And a nominee like Judge Bork, who had to talk about what he had said, is in a very different position from someone who hasn't spoken about contested legal matters. And I've gone on too long, but I just want to make one additional point, and that is, the confirmation, preparing for the hearing for a nominee, I think really entails figuring out exactly how much he or she must say, and then going no further at all.
Tom, do you have thoughts on that question?
Well, I do think the battle has turned into the idea of say what you need to in order to get confirmed. A judge is like a piece of legislation. You do what you need to get the level of support, and given the partisan alignment, so that in the last five nominations, only one member of the president's party has ever voted against the president's nominee. You know, when you don't have divided government in particular, there's just no incentive to fix the system. The senators, you can't compile a majority of the senators to insist. And While Republican senators would want more direct answers from a Democratic nominee, then, you know, when the tables are turned, the opposite will be true. So it's a, in my mind, a really systemic problem. We just, there's none of the incentives exist to get to the right result here, I'm afraid.
A related question is how the president can determine whether a prospective nominee shares his judicial philosophy. So recently, President Obama gave a little bit of a clue in a statement that he was looking for somebody who understood, or the president said that he believed in a right to bodily integrity, I think he said. And so my question is, how is he going to determine whether a nominee would share his view? The Senate Judiciary Committee's questionnaire, which they require the nominee to respond to in writing, asks whether anybody involved in the process of selecting the nominee for the nomination, quote, ever discussed with you any currently pending or specific case, legal issue, or question in a manner that could reasonably be interpreted as seeking any express or implied assurances concerning your position on such case, issue, or question. So the Senate's position basically is if the president can ask you if you believe in a constitutional right to abortion, then we get to ask you the same question. So in light of that, presidents generally don't ask prospective nominees those sorts of questions. So how, in light of that, how can they get a window into judicial philosophy? And Sarah, I'll ask you that question first, since you worked on that in the Clinton administration.
Yeah, I mean, it's contrary to some reports. I mean, my experience during the Clinton administration was that there really was no litmus test. We didn't ask substantively based questions. But, you know, of course, a president is entitled to assess, as Congress is entitled to assess, sort of what the judicial philosophy of a candidate is, as well as temperament and other factors. Where a judge has a body of published decisional law, I think that's one, you know, obviously one place to look for indications of how a candidate approaches decision making. Same thing is true with academic articles or speeches. You know, I think it's important for the president and the advisors looking over any candidate's record to try and avoid, if possible, but it's really, really hard. And you know, I like the other commentators, don't think the confirmation process is going to get any more interesting anytime soon. You know, the record really is variable. It's really hard to sort of character. I think it's unfortunate that, you know, when you read decisional law and other pieces of a candidate's public record, you tend to, you know, look through this very simplistic political prism of whether something is going to create, whether there are any red flags. And it doesn't really do justice to the sort of nuances and complexity that, you know, any typical candidate being considered for such an important spot generally brings to the table.
Dave, do you have any thoughts about that?
You know, I think it's very difficult, other than to look at the, you know, the judicial decisions and the academic writings to get
a take
on.
So what if the person is neither a judge nor a law professor?
Well, I think that gets back to the point I made earlier, which is, you know, it's hard to get a good handle on a practicing lawyer, and because ideology has become such an important aspect of who you nominate, as Bill actually suggested during his opening, that used to not be the case. Justices were more interested in pleasing particular religious constituencies. For example, Pierce Butler, who I wrote about, was selected because he was, you know, he was a Catholic sort of social democrat, socially conservative Democrat. Those used to be the prevailing types of things that more electoral concerns used to be the prevailing types of things that motivated presidents to make nominations. Now, because ideology has become such an important aspect of it, I think it's very, very difficult. And I think that's why we've seen presidents turn to sitting judges, because it's the only way to sort of, or at least former professors that have written something on constitutional law topics, because otherwise it's impossible to find out what those candidates or nominees believe.
Okay. My next question is about the politicization of the process. Everybody talks about the politicization of the process. Everyone thinks that it's bad to have a more political Supreme Court confirmation process. I personally am not sure whether the process now is more political than it has been historically. I do know that President Washington had trouble getting one of his Supreme Court justices confirmed. So I think it's always been political. But I'd be interested in the panelists' views on whether the process is more political now, whether that's bad, whether you think that today, if the Senate were of a party different from the president, that the president could get any Supreme Court nominee confirmed. Bill, what do you think?
Well, I think obviously the process has always been political and politicized, and some large number of nominees historically from the very beginning have failed to be confirmed. Commonly, and again, I'm talking off the top of my head on this, but it was uncommon for judicial philosophy to be the point of disagreement, other political factors, things about the nominee, et cetera. President Nixon famously said, "Well, you know, they won't confirm any Southerner," when he picked Justice Blackmun third, who obviously is from Minnesota. So it's always been political in the sense of regional politics and things like that. I think it really is only in the last generation or so that the process has become both politicized and about predicted outcomes by judges. And I think that is, I'm not even sure it's regrettable. It's just the way where we are. It's not going to change. The role of the court has become so much more central and so important, and everyone expects the court to decide every big question. And for heaven's sake, it would be quite surprising, in light of the role of the modern court in deciding what it does, it would be very surprising if the process weren't politicized. If a person is going to be wielding power that you can't hold them accountable for afterwards, you want to make sure that you're very careful about who gets that power. So, I think it has become quite politicized, and I don't think that's going to change.
Tom, Justice Thomas was confirmed even after his extraordinarily bruising confirmation process with the Democratic majority in the Senate. I think the Democrats maybe had 53 votes at that time. Do you think that is even conceivable now, just such a short period of time after Thomas was confirmed?
I don't think that that Justice Thomas's confirmation hearings in this environment would come out the same way, because, you know, each time there's a greater focus on ideology. I agree with what's been said so far. And so what will happen the next time a Republican president, Democratic senator, or the reverse will be a fascinating question. I expect there's going to be a greater tendency towards nominations like John Roberts and Elena Kagan, to folks who have been involved in a presidential administration, who are known commodities to decision makers there, but don't have a long track record. But I actually think that will, that may be more important for the question of whether or not there's a big political fight than whether a nominee would be filibustered, for example. Thus far, the firewall on Supreme Court nomination filibusters has held. And even with a nominee like Diane Wood, we haven't heard serious discussion of filibustering her, and she's the sort of the most prominent, most liberal nominee that's under consideration right now. So I think that we're kind of on the cusp of whether this is going to tilt into just all-out war, where we have groups who exist financially just to attack and defend nominees, or could return to a system of kind of Cold War hostility, where presidents can be encouraged to put people on the bench who are experienced judges and are knowledgeable and thoughtful people, without having to make just kind of the most crass political judgments.
Okay, Sarah, do you have thoughts about that? You mentioned earlier that you were considering a potential Stevens replacement at a time when there were Republicans in the Senate. What are your thoughts about how that would play out now? And teeing off what Tom said, were the outside interest groups as influential and important to your administration as they are now?
Yeah, I think the outside interest groups were very much heard and consulted with. Not always happy with Clinton judicial picks, but nevertheless an important, part of the consultative process. One factor I wanted to throw into the mix here is you know, an important consideration for any president, you know, irrespective of party, is, you know, how a particular new Supreme Court justice is going to be able to hold their own within the mix of justices already on the court. And, you know, I think that, you know, I would expect that the folks in the counsel's office who are looking at the records of various candidates are, you know, for example, just to pick Merrick Garland off the list, you know, his dissent in the Totten versus Bombardier case, the False Claims Act case, involving the presentment clause of the False Claims Act, where Justice Roberts, now Justice Roberts, then D.C. Circuit Judge Roberts, wrote the majority opinion. You know, looking at decisions, that's not on a particular hot button issue like abortion, for example, or the Establishment Clause. It's on sort of more of a humdrum kind of federal statutory issue. But you can discern a lot from reading dissents and seeing how judicial decision makers sort of wrestle with the majority opinion and glean a lot from those that kind of exercise. Tom referenced Kagan's article on, I think it was actually a book review of Yale Law Professor Stephen Carter's book, The Confirmation Mess. And she really decried what she called substantive ciphers, you know, what she called the confirmation process an intellectual farce. And, you know, said that the bottom line issue in the appointment process is the kinds of, or the kinds of judicial decisions that will, that Congress is entitled to probe, you know, that any candidate will make, potentially make. And it's just difficult to, one, you know, we all are sort of wishing that it could be a more robust and sort of meaningful intellectual exercise. You know, I just think the confirmation politics have become so sharp, and the margin of, you know, dominance by one party or the other so slim that it makes it too risky to have a more open-ended and sort of transparent discussion about judicial philosophy.
Okay. Dave remarked earlier that he thinks that this next appointment nomination will be extremely important because Justice Stevens will be such a will leave such a gaping hole in the court. He's been so influential. He's been the leader of the left-leaning bloc on the court. Do the rest of you agree with that, or do you agree with what seems to be the prevailing view in the press that it's not going to make much of a difference because the president will just be replacing a liberal with a liberal? Any reactions to that from any of you? Tom?
In terms of the trajectory of the court?
Right. I mean, how important is this?
This is a fantastic point in time for the president's legacy. So we're talking about somebody who's going to be on the court for 30 more years, and so it's every seat is significant in that respect. But I really agree with the earlier comments about how important Justice Stevens is to the left. That's true just because he's extremely experienced, has really matured into a role, mature into something between 80 and 90 over the last 10 years as the leader of the left, gone from being in 8-1 dissents all the time to being the author of 5-4 majorities in significant cases. The assignment power that comes from being the senior associate justice when he's in the majority, and his relationship of trust, because I do think he's a really respected person in the building. I personally think there is nothing the president can do that will stop the court from moving to the right as a consequence of Justice Stevens' departure. Even if you put somebody who's as liberal as him on the court, which seems to me extremely unlikely, they don't have his stature, his assignment power, his experience, all the things that we've talked about in this call. And so the left is going to lose material ground. The one thing that might push back on that is that it'll be the first time ever that if Justice Kennedy votes with the left, he gets to assign himself the opinions, which will it'll be interesting to see how often that happens.
Dave or Bill, do you have reactions to that?
Yeah, I think Tom makes an interesting point, and I agree with him. I think that Justice Stevens, he's well liked by everyone on the court. He's sort of an institution at the court, having served, you know, more than 30 years. He's had the assignment power really on the left since, I'm trying to think, maybe Justice Brennan left the court. He served under Justice Brennan, who was famous for being a great politician on the court, much like Justice Stevens has turned into, in terms of putting together majority coalitions. You know, there's some famous stories about Justice Brennan putting together majority coalitions when they were about to fall apart, coming up with unique ways to decide cases to keep a majority together. I think that Justice Stevens probably learned a lot from that and has been a real reliable leader based on his experience on how well-liked he is on the court in terms of keeping together either dissenting coalitions or majority coalitions, as the case may be. I think it's going to be more difficult probably for the left to court Justice Kennedy, to keep him. I think that Justice Stevens was great at that. So I think that's going to be a hole. I do think that Tom is absolutely right, that it's going to be fascinating to see what Justice Kennedy does with the assignment process. Because if he votes with the more liberal members of the court, he gets to keep the assignment or assign the opinion. And there's some famous examples during particularly the Burger Court era when particular members of the court appeared to vote a particular way to keep the assignment power for themselves. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens over the next several years as a new justice tries to replace Justice Stevens.
I agree with all those comments. I will note, though, that all of the sort of candidates who have been focused on by the press, at any rate, Garland, Kagan, and Wood, have been sort of singled out for their ability to build consensuses in the institutions in which they've, either been judges or academics.
I guess I don't agree, at least in part. In particular, I don't agree that the court will certainly move right after Justice Stevens leaves. It would be extremely surprising to me if, in any material way, a justice appointed by President Obama is more conservative than Justice Stevens. Maybe on isolated questions, there might be a flip-flop between the two, the past and the present. But I think that it's unlikely that the president's nominee is going to disappoint the president very often. And as far as Justice Stevens' influence in the court, anybody who is there as long as he has been and is a person who treats other people well as he does is going to be influential, and that's a loss whenever a justice leaves. I guess my own vision of him as a political mastermind walking the halls is not the same as my colleagues here. But I do think that the people who you read about the president's considering right now are all very able, the Merrick Garlands and Elena Kagans and Diane Woods of the world. I don't think there's going to be a big drop-off between the new justice and Justice Stevens, except insofar as you always have a drop-off if you lose someone who's obviously been around a very long time.
Okay, we're going to close now with some concluding thoughts by each of the panelists. Tom, you want to start?
Sure. I just want to say again how much I've enjoyed this and appreciate the Federal Society putting it together and the folks who've been on the panel. I've learned a lot. I guess I'll close with a prediction, and that is I do think that this is the last opportunity that President Obama in a first term is going to have to shape the Supreme Court. I think there's a lot of expectation that Justice Ginsburg is going to retire, that she would want to avoid the prospect of President Obama losing a reelection fight and then stepping down under a Republican president. I think that will not be true. I think that she's committed to staying on the court and not concerned about what will happen in the next 5 or 6 years because she believes she'll be on the court longer than that. So President Obama in his first term gets two confirmations, which is a significant opportunity to put his stamp on the court, but this will be it.
Thanks, Tom. Dave?
Yeah, I wanted to address the politicization point just a bit, which is I do think, we've had discussions about the politicization of the process, the confirmation process, and I do think it's more politicized than it's ever been. And I think that's a result of at least a couple of factors. One is the pervasiveness of interest groups. They're now more involved than ever. And I think the best evidence of that is that there was a book written a few years ago talking about how interest groups were never involved in circuit court appointments, and now they're heavily involved, and they often testify and make statements about potential nominees, both to the circuit courts and to the Supreme Court. So I think that the interest groups have certainly led to a more politicized judiciary. Secondly, I think that Ben Wittes wrote a book several years ago where he posited that Brown versus Board of Education was a turning point for the courts, because the courts started making social policy. And I hope I'm not misquoting him or mischaracterizing him here, but I think that there's been other opinions that have certainly politicized the court, decisions about abortion, decisions about affirmative action. All of these things, I think, have led to greater politicization, because there's more at stake for each Supreme Court appointment. I think that's going to continue to be true. I think that there's no easy fix to the process. I'm often asked when I present on confirmations and appointments, what's the answer? And I really don't think there is an answer. The only way nominees are going to answer questions is if the Senate decides, hey, we're not going to confirm somebody who doesn't answer questions, and I don't see that happening anytime soon. So I think we're on the same trajectory. Whether it's a good or a bad thing, I don't know. But I think it's going to be interesting to see where the process goes over the next 15 to 20 years.
Thanks. Sarah, your turn.
Thanks, Rachel. This has been a terrific panel. I guess I would close with the observation that as important as any Supreme Court vacancy is, that I would hope that neither the President nor the Senate would lose sight of or give short shrift to the significance of filling other lower court vacancies, particularly in these times of intense economic insecurity and national security issues. I think it is absolutely critical that the American people have a working federal judiciary, and irrespective of the viewpoints and philosophies of judges, that branch of the government is functioning, civil, and filled to capacity. So I hope the administration does not ignore and the Senate do not ignore the significance of filling the appellate and district court vacancies as well.
Thank you. And finally, you, Bill.
Thanks, Rachel. On the last point, I agree. And the one of the realities that struck me on the inside was, boy, the time is really, really short. The calendar inside a White House is relentless. Every single day counts. And it's amazing to me that they've been this slow in getting nominees out. And I think they're going to regret it, because you just don't know what the future is going to hold for the president's party in the Senate or the president himself in 2012. On the bigger questions, I've been kind of pessimistic in so far in talking about the inevitable politicization of the confirmation process, and I think that. But all is not lost. We have recent history of two nominees from the Democratic president being confirmed overwhelmingly with overwhelming Republican support. Both Justice Ginsburg and Justice Breyer were confirmed very easily. So the future might hold such compromise for us as well, but it's got to be a two-way street. It makes me pessimistic when you reflect on the fact that the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, the Chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the Majority Leader of the Senate all voted against cloture for the most recent Republican nominee, Justice Alito. And they're not going to have a lot of credibility in calling for comity and cooperation from the Republicans in light of their behavior and, frankly, the behavior of their caucus over the course of the last administration. So if we're ever going to solve the problem, it's going to have to be, I think, prospective against a veil of ignorance from both parties. I hope that happens sometime, but I don't think it's reasonable or realistic to expect either party to stand down unilaterally. Thank you.
Thank you to our panelists, and thank you to our audience for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For related materials to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. Thank you.